Thank you so much for joining us today for the Financial Review. Our next guest is a professor of public policy, a behavioral economist at Harvard Kennedy School, combining insights from economics and psychology to improve business and decision-making in organizations and society, served as the academic dean of the Kennedy School, co-chair of the Behavioral Insights Group, and associate director of the Harvard Decision Science Laboratory, also an author of multiple economics articles and papers, and author of a new book, What Works? What Works? Now, from this description, an economist, Harvard University, is our author male or female? Well, it's a good question, and it has implications on how you might look at this author's work. Our guest is Iris Bonnet, author of What Works? Gender Equality by Design. Dr. Bonnet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I presented it that way because that was actually roughly based upon an idea of who would make a better employee or a better boss, Howard or Heidi, and what this might tell us about stereotypical behavior. Tell us a little bit about that story of Howard or Heidi and the difference that that makes and what that test was about.
So Heidi Roizen is a real person. She is a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And a few years ago, a colleague of mine at the Harvard Business School wrote a case study on Heidi, detailing how Heidi ran her businesses and how she built networks in Silicon Valley. And then a few years later, some other colleagues had the creative idea to exchange Heidi with Howard and give half of their students the very same case, with the protagonist being called Howard, meaning being a man, and the other half of the student received the original case with the protagonist being called Heidi. And after the students had read the case, they had all students fill out a survey where they asked the students how well they thought this entrepreneur did. And they asked a number of questions, not just how competent the person was, but also how likable. Would they be willing to work with her? Could they imagine hiring someone like him or her, depending on the case they saw, etc.? And what they found was somewhat depressing, namely that students agreed that both Heidi and Howard had done a very good job, but they liked Heidi less than Howard and indicated that they would be less willing to work with Heidi than with Howard. That is the power of stereotypes. In fact, now the two cases, are a useful tool for us to teach our students about stereotypes and about bias and having them experiencing it in the moment. And it is happening because we don't naturally associate venture capitalism or venture capitalists with women.
We don't typically associate women as economists either, do we?
That is true, yes. We certainly are a minority in our profession.
And we take that a step beyond, and a lot of people don't think that women can be mathematicians or scientists or carpenters or plumbers.
That is right, but it works the other way around as well. So men fall prey to the very same type of stereotypes in counter-stereotypical jobs. So we don't see men as nurses or kindergarten teachers.
Although I would imagine there are some men who would make good nurses or kindergarten teachers.
Oh, absolutely. Much the same as women can make good economists or good mathematicians. Absolutely.
So are there some realities that are based on these biases, or do realities come about because of these biases?
Interestingly enough, I think the answer to both of your descriptions is yes. So on the one hand, seeing is believing. And if we don't see male kindergarten teachers, or if we don't see female economists, we don't naturally associate those jobs with men or women respectively. So in that sense, yes, reality forms our mindsets and our beliefs. But they can turn into self-fulfilling prophecies. And what we sometimes describe as descriptive norms, just kind of describing that, for example, 10 to 15% of our teachers are male, can turn into what we call prescriptive norms, which are norms which tell us what the world should look like. And I think that's where we get into that difficult territory where a male teacher, for example, would have to outperform his female counterparts just to be competitive.
And this results in some other problems as well because, as you say in the book, many times a young student will learn better from a same-sex teacher. So in other words, the girl learns better from a female teacher, the boy learns better from a male teacher. So we may be hurting the education of young boys by having these kinds of biases.
You're absolutely right. Role models do matter, whether in schools or in our organizations or businesses, so really across the board. And research by the OECD now suggests that our 15-year-old boys are lagging behind our 15-year-old girls by about a year across all OECD countries in reading and writing. In contrast, the girls are starting to close the gender gap in math and lag behind at this point only a couple of months, and they have completely closed the gap in the sciences. So yes, we should absolutely be concerned about who is in our classrooms and can our students identify with the person who is teaching them math or reading and writing.
There are also some really interesting implications that came up in this new book, and the title of the book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. What works? For example, you brought up the point about Japan. Any of us who have followed economics and finance over the past few years knows that Japan has been experiencing economic stagnation. Recently, they've tried economic stimulus. They call it Abenomics, and it's a combination of fiscal and monetary policy. You say that the answer may be as simple as hire more women.
It's not the only answer. Clearly, Japan has to do many different things. But in fact, one of the priorities of the current government is to increase workforce participation of women, because what they realize is that the country is shrinking, that with only one or so child per family, that is below subsistence rate. So the country will, by necessity, have to shrink unless they add more women or more foreigners to their workforce. And so, yes, so economists' projections suggest that by adding substantially more women, in fact, for example, by equalizing the fraction of women who work to the fraction of men who work, Japan's economy would grow substantially. But Japan is not the only country. I mean, other countries which have relatively few children, including Germany, including South Korea, face some of the same problems. It's not quite as pronounced as in Japan, partly because they are more open to immigrants and so therefore can replace the workforce by other people. But still, this is true across the board.
Interesting point here. I believe it was an IMF study that you cited, stating that not hiring women in a circumstance like that equals a loss of about 40% of per capita income. That's a huge difference. So when we think about this and then we think about gender bias, the big question is, why does this bias still exist? Is it just the concept that we're looking at a zero-sum game? I'm afraid that I'm going to lose a piece of my pie?
Partly that is certainly true. And the business case itself won't solve the problem. I mean, the business case for gender diversity has been around for a number of years now, and it can be demonstrated at the level of teams and also at the level of the macroeconomy, as we've just discussed now. But yes, it is very, very persistent, and partly it is that people fear that this could be a zero-sum game and that your gain, in fact, is my loss. But that really isn't the whole story. it is much deeper than that. It also concerns people like you and me who don't want to be biased, and we don't want to be sexist or racist or many of the other things that we don't want to be, but we can't help do it. And that, in fact, is a very important message of my book. This is not about pointing fingers at bad people. This is about understanding how our minds work and creating an environment where, for our biased minds, it becomes easier to get things right.
So we can overcome this by training, or is there something better than just training?
So certainly we collectively in the United States have been investing quite a lot of money and quite a lot of time in diversity training programs. Some estimates would say about $8 billion a year are spent on diversity training programs by businesses in the United States. Now, sadly enough, when I set out to write this book, I wanted to go out there and find evidence on what we know about whether this works. And so my sadly before is related to the finding that we actually know very little about whether this is working or not. This is partly due to the fact that companies typically do not evaluate the impact of their diversity training programs. And that's, in fact, a very important message of my book as well, that we have to do a better job measuring what works and what doesn't work, therefore the title, What Works. But the summary of that chapter on diversity training is basically that either we don't know whether it's working, or based on the evidence that we have, which is based on correlations. And correlations are trying just to understand whether there's a connection between whether or not a given company has a diversity training program and the diversity of the workforce of that company. So is that in any way connected? And the researchers who looked at that very question found that there's basically no connection. So at this point, I'm not particularly optimistic that debiasing mindsets is going to work. And my somewhat depressing conclusion at this point is also based on many, many years of research trying to understand whether we generally can debias people. So biases are with us not just in terms of gender and race or nationality or people's looks, but generally many biases are just due to how our minds work, and we make lots of mistakes. And behavioral scientists and behavioral economists like myself have actually been studying that very question for really decades at this point, trying to understand, you know, what does training do? And even more generally in terms of debiasing, we haven't been very, very successful. Our minds are pretty stubborn.
Indeed they are. And I was hit by that as I read the book. You gave a couple of examples and little tests. It's not as if there's a big quiz on the book here, but there are a couple of little tests, and we just naturally, I don't think that I'm particularly biased, but it turns out I have some biases.
Yes, and I'm trying to make it easy for the reader, like readers like you, as I said, who are good people and don't intentionally want to discriminate against people, to experience bias in the moment. And so one of the little tests that is in the book has people make associations between certain things, and it turns out that unusual association take longer. So, for example, if I ask you to think about the connection between men and women and business and home, you generally would find it easier to make a connection between men and business and women and home. I mean, that's not rocket science. But it is a way for people to experience, even in the moment, that certain connections are just come to us naturally. And so when we see something that doesn't look natural, our first reaction is surprise, maybe even shock, and maybe even a sense of wanting to run away.
Hang on just a moment. We will dig into this and we'll pull a curtain in front of this problem in just a moment as we continue our conversation with Idris Bonnate. What Works? Gender Equality by Design. That's the new book. What Works? Gender Equality by Design. We'll continue in just a moment. Money Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Iris Bonnett, and she is the author of a new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. The last name is spelled B-O-H-N-E-T. What Works? Gender Equality by Design. This really is a massive problem, and it has been going on for a long, long time. But some of what you talked about in the book was really just startling. Not just gender bias, but even to go so far as to call it gendercide. We're losing an incredible talent pool and an incredible resource. Give us just a brief hint of what we're talking about there.
So gendercide stands for the sex selective abortion of girls in, sadly enough, many parts of the world, particularly prevalent in parts of Asia, where the United Nations now estimates that about 200 million women and girls are missing. And that is not just sex-selective abortion, but it is also neglect in the first 5 years. Research for India has shown that mothers tend to nurse their baby boys about twice as long as their baby girls. And so the baby girls are exposed to dirty water much earlier than their brothers. And it quite literally makes, as you said, gender bias a question of life and death. Now, having said this, I don't want to stop here because my book is actually trying very hard to focus on potential solutions. And many thought this is a cultural preference. Even, you know, if even mothers don't care about their daughters as much as about their sons. I mean, what can we do, or who are we, particular Westerners, kind of coming in and suggesting alternatives? So a colleague of mine, Rob Jensen, he's at the Wharton School, did something quite creative. He went into India and took advantage of the fact that many call centers moved into India in the 90s. And they preferably hire women. He ran an experiment. He hired a company that provided training for women to go and become call center workers. And he did that in an experimental fashion in that he chose a number of, so to speak, treatment villages which got the training. And then he had other villages which were in his control group. He measured not just whether the training worked and whether these women then would be more likely to work in the call centers, but more importantly, whether that affected how parents treated their daughters. And what he can show is that, in fact, these small opportunities did affect how parents treated their baby girls and increased their survival chances and their health. So that's the good news, that economic opportunity, yes, it is about, you know, women CEOs and women on boards, and all of that is important. But it really, it can be a matter of life and death, and it can affect how parents treat their kids.
I thought one of the more interesting experiments really brought the point home, and that was a symphony orchestra. And as recently as 20-some-odd years ago, symphony orchestras were almost entirely male and, for that matter, white. I believe it was Boston Symphony that you brought to our attention. In hiring new members of the orchestra, they did a sound test where the person was hidden behind a curtain, and it was just the quality of the music being produced. All of a sudden, they started hiring more women.
That's exactly right. And so selection committees and orchestra directors could not see who played the music. Mm-hmm. And that increased the likelihood that women would advance to future rounds by 50%. To now, about 40% women musicians on those major orchestras. So yes, it's an important demonstration of bias, of how powerful the bias is, even of well-intentioned people. And secondly, it also is an important example of a behavioral design intervention. This was not about changing mindsets, but just a bit of technology, a curtain, making it easier for biased minds to get things right and benefit from 100% of the talent pool.
The book really is quite incredible. Iris Bonnett, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. Very enlightening and informative book and a lot of fun to read. What Works? Gender Equality by Design. Dr. Bonnett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.